I am told that this will be the 16th appearance.
Wow.
Could that be true? Could this be true? It could be true. I am told that this is the 16th appearance of our guest tonight, Dave Rico, which would make him by far the most popular speaker, author that we've had here at Many Rivers Books and Tea, if only in appearance. But he also draws many readers because he has, as you see over here, many books, CDs as well, over the years, a prolific author. I was thinking about Dave's work this afternoon and realizing or reimagining that how well he brings together three ideational fields. One is that of Christianity and Catholicism, another is that of psychology, another is that of Buddhism. So it seems to me that his work is informed by his explorations in those arenas, and it has been meaningful for many readers. It has been meaningful for many listeners here at our store and in other locales. Please join me in welcoming again to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Dave Rico.
Thank you all. Thanks for inviting me. And I want to share a little about my book. It's called You Are Not What You Think, The Ego-Less Path to Self-Esteem and Generous Love. Actually, the title came from a client, a guy who came to see me, and the first time he came in, I asked him, what do you want to work on? And this is what he said. I want to have less ego and more self-esteem. So that's where I got subtitled. The Ego-Less Path to Self-Esteem. And I'm going to make the distinction between ego and self-esteem as we go along. And I also have in the subtitle, Generous Love, the more you can let go of what's called a big ego, the more opportunity do you have to be effective in a relationship. So let me start with just kind of mentioning what's in the table of contents. I start with what is ego. Ego is simply the Latin word for I, but it has a variety of meanings, as you'll see. And what is egotism? Then I go in, chapter 2 is about fear, the kind of fear that's behind someone's needing to be so blustery and puffed up about himself. But behind that is a lot of insecurity. Then I make the distinction between healthy ego and egotism. So what does it take to have a healthy ego? That's what we want. And what would be an impoverished ego? So some people have too much ego, some people have not enough. And we want the Goldilocks, the just right. So that I try to explain what that is. Then I try to show how it has its origins in childhood. And so many of the messages we received in childhood militate against our having a healthy ego, because it would mean a lot of self-confidence. And if they weren't helping you have self-confidence, it's hard to build it on your own. Then I go into ego and relationships. That's a big part of this whole thing. And finally, how we could tame and make friends with our ego, so that as a result, we open up to our true nature, which is our Buddha enlightened self, non-self, really. So let me start with just a short reading from the introduction. I'm on page 1. Any of us can at times be me-centered rather than we-centered, in a way that feels not quite right to others or even to ourselves. The most common nickname for this phenomenon of self-centeredness is ego. It's often not pretty in how it shows up, and we may feel ashamed when people call us on having a big ego. But it is possible to notice and feel compassion for whatever fear might lurk behind our self-importance and selfishness. So that's the theme throughout the book. How do we look at this with compassion and thereby set it free to open up into self-esteem? We can learn not to vilify our ego, but hold it respectfully and tame it tenderly. The male or female ego then becomes what it is meant to be, a sergeant, not a general, a lady in waiting, not a princess. So it does have a place in the human set of rankings, but it's not supposed to be the general. It can't be in charge when it is. Real love becomes impossible. The ego is healthy when it helps us fulfill our life goals. When it becomes too big for its britches, it turns into egotism, what is called a big ego. And we've all used that phrase. It's an enshrining of swagger and seeking to compensate. It's either an enshrining of swagger or it's seeking to compensate for a lack of it. That's a quote from Charles Blow, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, which I had just read when I was writing this. So this is the part of us that's always on the defensive, and it has a lot of bravado. None of that has to be bad. It becomes unskillful in our relating to other people when we think we're all it, and we have a kind of an arrogant manner, and we've all seen this in ourselves and others. I consider it a disability when it comes to relating. Here's why. In order to have a healthy relationship, you have to be able to say, "I'm sorry," sometimes. But this person can't be wrong, so he can't say, "I'm sorry." You have to be able to say thank you. He can't say thank you because you owe him. He's entitled. It isn't a gift. You're lucky to have him in the house, so you're supposed to be at his service. He can't ask for help because he has it all and he's in full control. He can't be corrected because he can't be wrong. And finally, he can't forgive because his favorite sport is retaliation. So you put those together, and if that's what your partner looks like, or if that's what you look like, it's going to be very difficult to have intimacy flourish. Everybody follow? So we need to find a way to let go of those mindsets, which is what this is. It's not, the ego is not an entity in the psyche. It's not like what Freud called the ego, which is the strong center of the personality that works toward goals, saying no to the messages that would pull him away from the goal, like become an addict, and saying yes to the reasonable demands that show him how to be civilized. And that centered self, Freud called the ego, that's the healthy ego that could gain self-esteem. But this other style of arrogance entitlement gets in the way of letting that flourish. Everybody follow? And I saw a very interesting quote that helped me when I was doing the research for this. I kind of know it by heart, but in case I can find it in here. Does everybody know who Rory McIlroy is? Here it is. So I'll just read the paragraph, because this brings us into another part of the topic, which I think is really important. It is never a good idea to eliminate ego attitude. Attitude is another word for big ego. He comes across with attitude. It's not a good idea to eliminate ego attitude altogether. We bring it out when appropriate and useful. We can learn just when to show it and when to leave it out. Irish golf pro, Rory McIlroy. A young expert golfer. Okay. Stated it well. Quote, "You know, I need that cockiness, the self-belief, the arrogance, the swagger, whatever you want to call it. I need that on the golf course because it brings out the best of myself as far as being skillful in playing the game. But once I leave the golf course, that all gets left behind." That's a perfect summary of how you can be wise enough to come across in a kind of heavy way in order to get things to work better or have people really get what you're trying to say. Rory McIlroy's swagger refers to the proud stance an athlete assumes on a playing field. This posture says, "I'm seriously into this, I'm ready, and I'm competent." Nothing wrong with that. But leave it on the field. Don't bring it home to a partner or to your family, because that's when you get into trouble. There's another reference to ego in the film 7 Years in Tibet. Some of you saw that film? I'll just read what it says here. In a marketplace, there's a scene in the marketplace where Brad Pitt and his friend and the friend's Tibetan girlfriend, they are walking through the marketplace, and there's a guy wrapping fish in newspaper. And Brad Pitt, an Olympic champion, sees his picture on the newspaper. So, Brad Pitt, the real life person, Heinrich Harrer, who had been an Olympic champion, finds an old newspaper with a picture of him receiving a sports award. He proudly shows it to Pema, a Tibetan woman friend. This is how she responds. She points out that in the West, accomplishment and victory matter, while in the East, it is letting go of ego that matters. This is our greatest spiritual accomplishment and the true gold prize. When I heard that line, I thought, wow, this is a summary of the difference between our Western values and Eastern spiritual style. Like, he's holding up the newspaper, look, I'm a big shot, which he is in real life. And she's saying, that can't matter as much as you letting go of your ego. That's what makes you a true champion in the spiritual world. So the style of this book is to combine respect for ego as a useful but seldom needed tool and compassion for the ego that fears what it most wants, and thus goes far astray from the love it seeks. We work gently with this scared part of ourselves. We do not abandon our ego. We rehabilitate it. We see the self-inflation, the prancing, the strut and swagger in ourselves and others, and we're touched by the pathos and pain behind it. This compassion toward ego helps us dissolve its aggressive exterior and release the core of gentle goodness, the true strength that has always been under it, our true nature beyond ego, our Buddha nature, an indelible, inviolable, and unconditional core of goodness, love, and humility, unmarred by our history, unhindered by our fears. And in the course of the book, I try to show how that can turn into helpful practices. So let me just give a couple of more examples, then we'll open it up for some discussion. So you might see someone being controlling, bullying, manipulative. That would be an example of this far extreme of ego, entitled to special treatment, cutthroat, competitive, highly critical of others but sensitive to criticism, can't receive feedback. You can't say, hey, could you try doing it this way? What do you mean? You're going to be, once you arouse that ego, and you can see it being aroused because suddenly the other person is defensive and aggressive, both on defense and offense at the same time, not like on the football field where one is one and the other is the other. This guy combines them both. And when that happens, you just have to back off. Don't try to make sense. Don't try to reason with someone. As soon as you see that arousal occur, you have to just kind of back off. Okay, questions about this part? You get the overall distinction?
Yeah, I have to ask you.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you can see that extreme ego, just like you said, getting aroused, and you back off, and that you can't. You can't back up far enough.
Good point.
Yeah,
sometimes it's impossible, you mean? I agree. Yeah. You see, it has a long shelf life. You know, it's not just up and down. It's up, stay up. And before going down, it will find some way to retaliate. Anything from a snide remark to some passive-aggressive style of... You see, you have to realize that this is the part of us that feels so isolated and unsupported. I'm the only one, and I have to take care of myself. Nobody else can be trusted. It is a trust issue.
It's difficult in the work environment, I think.
Yes.
I've found that I'm just having a hard time with, like, a boss, you know, that just has that kind of energy, and it's... Yeah, what do you do in those situations? That I found, like, just kind of, I either have to, you know, let go myself as far as my own ego, you know, and sometimes that works. Sometimes it does work, but it definitely makes for a difficult, you know, challenging environment, for sure.
I agree.
Almost toxic, I think, sometimes.
Yes, it is toxic.
I guess you either have to let it go and learn to deal with it, or else move on to another.
Yeah, we don't want to walk on eggshells all the time, afraid that it might become aroused. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not tenable in a relationship for very long. At work, you have to put up with it, because that's your bread and butter. But know, the other day I had such an interesting thought, and after all these years with the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, I never noticed something. But I noticed it a couple of days ago. I said to myself, okay, she sat at the table and she tried the first bowl of porridge and she said, it's too hot. And she immediately went to the next bowl and said, it's too cold. And she immediately went to the next one and said, this is just right, and ate it. And I said, that's the one thing that we don't do. We don't instantly go from, this doesn't work, so I'm going here.
Oh, yeah.
We stay 15, 20 years with this doesn't work before we go to the next. And I never noticed that. I thought, oh, she just, you know, she got it. No to that. Let's see what's next. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
Curious to just the idea of using ego in a healthy way really strikes me, and the subjectivity of that. It seems like it could easily lead to arrogance and, like, without a compass. How do we know when the right situations are? For myself, I know I'm pretty introverted, so I tend not to use that when it would be healthy. So I was wondering if you could speak to, like, the level of conscience and how to determine that.
You'd have to start practicing. I give practices in here of how to know just when the time has come to speak up strongly, that is, assertively, or when to hang back and just let it go. It is a skill, but it's one that can be learned. And just the fact that you're conscious of it is a really good start on it. You know, I was thinking of my son when he was in ninth grade, and, you know, he walks around like a big, he then was, you know, walking around like a big shot with his friends who are also look like they're big shots. And I got such a kick out of it. Now he's 44. And when he does that, it is not cute at all. And I thought, ah, that's another feature of this. It's cute when you're 2 years old, and it's cute all the way up to the ninth grade, unless you're one of the teachers. But at a certain point, it crosses over, and it's not cute anymore at all. And if you're doing this when you're 60, it's completely obnoxious. It's a holding on to something that is meant to protect you, but it doesn't really. Go ahead.
Don't forget what you're going to say.
Oh, no, I won't. Believe me.
Okay. I think it's risky to say, well, this is okay in some situations, and then you just automatically drop it or leave it and go into a different mode, because when you're in that aggressive or swaggery or overconfident mode, you're practicing that. You're ingraining it. You're conditioning it.
Mm.
And so how do you, if you're allowing that and even encouraging yourself, whether you're an athlete or whatever, and you think it's necessary, is that possible then, as you leave the golf course, you just drop it and go straight into another mode? I just think that sounds really risky.
You would have to get it that this is a persona that I'm presenting, and when I'm not in this persona, I need to go back to my set point.
So you're aware that it's a role you're playing.
Yeah.
So it's just play acting or something.
Yes. It should be just play acting. That's a very good way to put it. It should be theater. Like, this is how I'll make the other guys back off. That's okay. In sports. And some other. Let's say you're at a PTA meeting and the superintendent of school says, we're not going to allow the kids to read Catcher in the Rye. It's got too many swear words in it. And you're the mother with the, you know, 10th grader. You're going to speak up. You're going to make your voice heard. You're going to come across a lot of ego. No problem. That's what it's for. That's what I mean by it's a useful tool at times.
But can't you come across and be strong without doing it that way?
Yes, I use as the example of that. I use a good example of that in here, which is Atticus Finch. In To Kill a Mockingbird, I say, okay, his manner, get things done, don't let them get away with anything, but not in an arrogant, swaggering style. That's what we want. So my chapter on, okay, how do you take some of this and turn it into something that's healthy, that's your model. And it's interesting, the study done of all the characters of literature, like, you know, Rhett Butler and Atticus Finch and whoever, Captain Ahab, the most popular and most attractive character is Atticus Finch. And I believe it's for this reason. He gives you a model of human living that does not back down, but also does not cause harm, mm-hmm. and never retaliates.
Yeah, I think in essence the appeal in that character is that he appeals to justice, mm-hmm. which is beyond the ego. In that right. sense, he becomes a champion of it. Right, the energy flows through him. But as a sense of him being the source, no, the source is something deeper. So I think that's what, and when I hear you talk about ego, I hear you talk about what we would use the term narcissism, people who think they themselves are an end in themselves. There's nothing behind them. They are the source of what this is, where this is coming
yeah.
from. And there's nothing else behind it. That's not what I was going to say, by the way. But that's kind of what seems to come from.
It's like a scarecrow to a crow. It looks like a menacing character waving his arms, but there's actually nothing behind it.
Right. That's why I always thought it was interesting, the difference between the definition for agent, which is someone who acts in the interest of someone else, so it's separate from that person, and instrument, which is actually being an extension of something else.
Mm-hmm.
So we act in this ego, separate ego place, we act as an agent, as if we know God's will, so we're going to be a good representative of God's will, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we're separate from, we really separate ourselves from that. But if we act as God's instrument, then the ego is really just the way for us to be in this world, to be the voice of that.
Yes.
That's not what I was going to say.
Okay.
I was going to talk about my kids, because my kids, both of them, were pretty severely neglected before we adopted them. And they've gone through a tremendous amount of trauma-related issues in their lives. And what I see in them is this struggle to form an ego, a struggle to have an identity. And that's what seems to me keeps coming up with it when you mention the word. I keep thinking identification. Someone identifies with something. I see it like I have a lot of relatives in Canada. Part of the whole French-Canadian thing, and they're so identified with their language. You can't talk to them about it. They're so identified, so big of who they are, you can't even touch it, because you have that reaction you said, you have to back away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're so red-faced, just forget it. You're not going to be able to talk to them. My kids struggle with the fact that they don't have a strong sense of that identification.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, they're egoless, but not in the way that we would think is enlightened. There's this, it's a void.
Yeah, I call that an impoverished ego, or deflated. So I make the distinction between the three styles. So let me just use this see if this fits. So on one end, we have the not enough ego. I'm on 56. The not enough ego, that's the deflated. On the far right, we have too much ego. And this far right and left fits with politics too. And that's the inflated ego.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle, you have your just right, healthy ego. So let's use a couple of examples. So the one with the not enough ego has a deficient sense of self. The one with too much has an exaggerated sense of self. And the just right has a balanced sense of self. The not enough, low self-esteem. Too much, really low self-esteem, but acts as if it were high. The one in the middle is the appropriate one. Deflated ego, passive, dependent. Too much ego, can't relate as a partner, has to be one up. One in the middle, mutual respect. And so forth. So very loose boundaries for the passive one. Too rigid boundaries for the inflated one. And firm yet reasonably flexible boundaries for the healthy one.
It's really fascinating because my kids actually fit the too much as far as their behaviors.
Uh-huh.
But that wouldn't really characterize the nature of their sense of themselves.
Right. That fits.
Because of the nature of their early trauma.
And the final one I think is interesting. The one with the impoverished ego is controlled by the reactions of others. The one with too much ego is out of control in how he reacts. And the one in the middle is in control of his reactions. And a victim's style would be a person with a deflated ego.
And we have a culture that really rewards that inflated.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That's big time. That's where you ought to be.
Yeah.
Inflicting your will on the world.
Yes.
You know.
Last night I was at a meeting of our Sacred Heart group. There was at the Sacred Heart Boys High School, and one of the teachers was giving a talk because their style of teaching is trying to instill a sense of social responsibility in the students. So they just came back from a trip to, you know, a poor slum in Central America. They're trying to increase the students' sense that they have a calling when they graduate, do something to help the world. It's not just about learning algebra. Anyway, I'm very impressed with how they do things. But he said something interesting that I thought really made a lot of sense. And I said to him when he said this, gee, I wish I had been to this kind of high school. He said, we have worked with the, they're all boys. We have worked with the boys now. They no longer have to posture.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, we don't tell them not to posture. The older boys tell the younger ones.
That's awesome.
You know, you don't have to act like that here. We're all equal.
Mm.
I thought it was fascinating. I thought, wow, they're, you know, they're dealing with ego.
But there's no girls around.
They're getting them strong enough to face the female population. So let's just take a quick look at kind of an answer to the question you brought up. What would be some ways to let go of ego, the one that's oversized? I'm on 123. And my first realization is that the ego will never let go of itself. You can't get there from your ego. It has to be a grace from a power beyond you that helps you see the light. This is how I look at it. However, there are a few things you can't do. One, follow the golden rule, act toward others as you want them to act toward you. Just start right there. That will help. Keep the needs of others in mind, an antidote to selfishness. It's okay to be a big shot, just don't act that way. Let go of ranking, especially seeing yourself above others. Acknowledge when you don't know something or you need support or help. Take feedback as useful information, even if it's meant as criticism. Apologize when you know you harm someone. Make amends. These would all stick in the craw of someone with an oversized ego. Don't try to control, dominate, or manipulate others. Cooperate rather than compete. Give up having to take center stage. Work conflicts out with people. Remain on high alert for the entry of ego into any interaction. The moment when you take what happened personally, when you become indignant, when you interpret someone's word or action as a slight to your dignity, the minute that happens, you know your ego's been aroused. And you're going to have to learn to quiet it down on your own. When someone's ego is aroused towards you, don't compete. Find a way to treat it with loving kindness. Don't hold a grudge against those who wrong you, even when they won't admit it. And stop telling the story of how they offended you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for or wish enlightenment for those who have disappointed, betrayed, failed, or mistreated you. And finally, see losing face as a welcome opportunity for growth and humility. Losing face is losing ego. That's what's meant by face in that instance. Questions about this part? Oh, I found my little poem. You're going to love this one. We end this chapter on a humorous note. Of course, I couldn't say it's me, but I can tell you. Diego, Diego, D-I-E-G-O. My own little pun. We end this chapter on a humorous note. Diego, now in recovery from egotism, and it does take a 12-step program sometimes, wrote this poem to his former wife as an amends for being so vindictive during their divorce years ago. And this is my poem to my wife, ex-wife. After you broke up with me, this fine feathered ego was just too stuffed to eat crow. That's my poem. After you broke up with me, this fine feathered ego was just too stuffed to eat crow. Yeah, I just wrote that automatically and I thought, wow, that's really summarized the whole thing. And I end I end that chapter with a sentence from The Course in Miracles. Your choice to use this device of ego enables it to endure. It endures because we keep using it. You know, what's that statement? If you don't use it, you'll lose it. Is that
use it or lose it?
Yeah, lose it.
Use it or lose it.
You will never lose ego if you keep using it. That's what she's saying.
Lose it, don't use it.
Yeah. Okay, other questions or comments about this part? Iana?
Yeah, it really takes a lot of compassion for oneself because this is a very up and downhill journey that we're on. And lots of twists and turns. And so sometimes we go forward and sometimes we fall back a little. And, but if we see it and go, oops, guess what? I just did.
Wait a minute, that was my ego.
Wait a minute, that was my ego. And then we can get ourselves up off the ground and go forward again.
Yeah, once we would have to be motivated to want to let go of ego. And I point out in here, sometimes the only way it can happen is through a big comeuppance. So one of the archetypal themes, because this is written with a Jungian orientation, one of the archetypal themes is little overcomes big. Example, David and Goliath. St. George and the dragon. Robin Hood and the king. There are hundreds of stories in which some minor, ordinarily weak character brings down the big, powerful, royal enemy, or even little Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. You just see it over and over.
Sanders and Trump.
There you go.
Sanders and Trump. Yeah, that would
Sanders
be a good one.
Clinton.
Let's hope that happens. So little overcomes big. That's the comeuppance. How did I... Like the Tsar of Russia is overcome by the peasants. 1917. Perfect example. The witch in The Wizard of Oz, she even says it when Dorothy throws the water on the witch. Not meaning to harm the witch, she was trying to put the fire out. But she doesn't realize that the evil witch can't stand water, starts to melt. This is what she says. Oh, what a world, what a world. Who would have thought a little girl like you could destroy all my beautiful power?
I think she says beautiful wickedness.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wickedness, yeah. Okay. So, like, the little overcame the big. Little human girl overcomes the powerful witch. So, that's what's meant by a comeuppance. Like, you get fired... you find out your spouse has been having an affair all these years, you get dumped, somebody shows you you're not all cracked up to be. Those are all archetypal examples of another way for the ego to take a bow. That something will happen that shuts down the inflation. That punctures the big balloon. Other questions about this?
It makes me wonder if you had any examples for that opposite big small dichotomy with the deflated ego half of things. What the archetype?
Oh, deflated ego would be helped by the mentor archetype or the one who encourages. Like the coach who tries to help the kid who's kind of awkward, give him extra time so he can be good playing the game.
That's a Rudy example.
It would be like, you know, somebody who helps you find your real potential, who trusts in you, believes in you. Mm-hmm. And often it's a teacher. I saw this movie last.
Use the term your champion.
Yeah. Yeah, someone who champions you.
Alchemical notion of your alchemical gold. Your alchemical gold has to go to someone else to hold it till you're ready. Mm-hmm. And give it back to you.
Yeah. Till you're ready to own it. Somebody else might believe in you before you believe in yourself.
Yeah, if you see your gold too soon, you become an egoist. You think it's you. Is that something that's moving?
Yes, and when you brought that up, you're reminding me that it's a grace to let it go.
Yes.
It's the power of grace that comes through and helps you with the deflation. I mean, Christianity has this archetype as the central belief that God Himself incarnated Himself into a helpless infant on Christmas Day. The big became the little. No power to protect Himself. And hands Himself over to this couple who have to then take care of Him. That's certainly an archetype of how the what looked like the impossible is able to happen. That bigness can come into us if we make ourselves small at first. Yeah.
I really was fascinated with your examples of the little overcoming the big, Robin Hood, David, Goliath, the Tsar, Joan of Arc, and then also as you brought up the other way of the big helping the small. And to me, the element or the orientation that brings a lot of meaning of how that worked is love. You know, Robin Hood, Joan of Arc, David, the peasants, Dorothy are a different place than Ego, and they are what made that defeat or overcome or change the world of the bigness that was perhaps doing evil. And in the case of like the teacher or the mentor, the big helping like a child and building their self-esteem and coming to their rescue or aid in the way that would be most beneficial, it's the caring, it's the love, it's the attention, it's the holding that is that empowerment. So I think that, you know, you have those two incredible examples of the different size dynamics. I think that is the quality that is at work, that is what I would want to get a picture of it and see that is what the important element is in those cases.
Yes.
I think the story has all the elements. As Ulysses, the Odyssey, it has all those elements.
Mm-hmm. He's helped by the little, he helps the others. Yes.
And then in the end, he gets whittled down to this place to have to finally come home. After all he's been through.
Yeah.
And he's the clever one.
So these stories were like the original psychology. And that reminds me, I won't go into it now, but I have my... this is a plate from the 5th century Greek world. And it's, you'll read about it in the appendix. These are the parents of Achilles, the great hero of the Trojan War. The woman is a goddess, and his mother was a goddess, and his father is a mortal person. And in the picture, which I know you can't see it very well, but she's holding three serpents. In order for a mortal man to marry a goddess, he first has to be initiated. He has to bow, as you see him doing, to her divinity. I'm on page 163. And she has three serpents which have to bite him in three places. The first serpent is biting him between his two eyes. That's his third eye of wisdom. So he will no longer be forced to see the world only with male logic he will have the female wisdom. That's the first snake. He submits to this because it's the only way to get married. The second snake bites him behind the ear so that he will be able to hear the music of the spheres, because they believed that when the stars go through the heavens, they emit a musical sound which only goddesses and gods can hear. So she's giving him the gift of hearing the music of nature. And the third snake, which is important, the one important to us, bites him in his Achilles tendon, which will be his son's downfall. That represents the male ego. She is severing the Achilles tendon. She is severing the ego. That's how you get ready for a spiritual relationship. That's the point of the story. Isn't that powerful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'll go through and explain the whole thing. But to me, it's about ourselves. You know, it's about what we go through. So I'd just like to end with the final paragraph of the book, and then we will. I'll be here if you want to do some. Come up to have me sign. So now I'm on 162. We can always go to our best, never erased, enlightened settings rather than to our Cro-Magnon, to those of our Cro-Magnon ancestors. They would be killed. We can see ourselves as members of the family of humanity, not as egotists taking pride of place. We then overturn our ego-driven assumptions, beliefs, and entitlements in favor of universal caring. We joyously contact the fullness of our humanity, finally find and live from our true nature, the reversal of ego into love. Now each of us can place his or her singular assortment of gifts into the service of humanity. We are still individuals, but in a world community that has waited since time began for the unique brand of love that only we can show. Here it is, we jubilantly avow, while our ego takes a bow. So thank you all. Well, I promised to end with a poem, so I'm going to give one final one. And this is by Edwin Markham. And it says a lot about, you know, when your ego becomes healthy. They drew a circle to shut me out. Called me heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and brought them in. That would be the style of the healthy ego.
Is that in there?
Yes.
Oh, awesome.
I think it is.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was wonderful. And
my pleasure.
Thank you all for coming tonight. Many of you know that we have a donation bowl over on the counter. We encourage you to contribute to help maintain this space for further such events, as well as to share with our speaker for his time. And of course, we have a ton of the newest book, as well as many, although not inclusive of all, of it, Dave's previous books. So please check those out on the way out. And thank you so much for coming tonight. We'll look forward to seeing you at future events, including tomorrow night for our concert. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.